Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well.
I have been preparing for a presentation that I'm going to do at my good buddy Kenny McElroy's Limitless event coming up in about a week. And I've really been trying to think through the global monetary system and what it's going to look like in the future. And you can tell how much of a macro geek I am because how many people enjoy allocating their time to thinking about such things. But I thought I would go over kind of my ideas so far, because for those, I'm assuming most Rebel Capitalists here on this channel are interested. You're macro geeks just like I am. And I think this will help you get your head around what the global monetary system was, how it worked, how it's working today, and how it will most likely work in the future, and what that means for you. What that means if you're the average Joe and Jane. What does that mean for your kids? What does that mean for your ability to increase your standard of living? The global monetary system, and most people don't know this, but the rebel capitalists do. The global monetary system is the linchpin to the entire global economy. If that goes down, the whole house of cards goes down. And we got just a glimpse of that during 2008, during the last GFC, because the last GFC really wasn't about subprime. Now, those of you who have watched a lot of my videos or watched Snyder's videos, you know what I'm talking about. For a lot of you, that may come as a surprise. You may be shocked. Well, what do you mean, George? Of course, the GFC, the global financial crisis of 2008, was because of subprime lending. In fact, with that Michael Burry video I did last night on the whiteboard video, that's like blowing up, I had a lot of comments saying, oh, George, well, now this time it's different because we don't have these ninja loans and blah, 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 blah. Look, that wasn't the reason we had the global meltdown. That was part of it. But if the euro dollar system would not have been fragile, and I'm going to get into this in just a moment, Ben Bernanke, and I hate to say this, but Ben Bernanke would have been right. Subprime would have been contained. But what he didn't understand, or what he didn't admit to, is that subprime was part of a system that had been radically overleveraged since 1955. And because of government distortions, and because of the bailouts creating moral hazard, and what I'm referring to specifically is long-term capital management back in the 90s. This created a global monetary system that was functioning definitely on all eight cylinders, but it was just like our global supply chain prior to the Cerveza sickness. It was working real, real well, but boy, oh boy, is it fragile. It's like a race car. It's like a Ferrari that it can go 200 miles per hour, but boy, oh boy, can that thing break down in a hurry. And when it breaks down, it's done. You're not getting it back on the road until you like rebuild the motor or something like that. And it's the exact same thing that happened. So then the question becomes, well, we didn't fix the euro dollar system. So how are we not in a global economic depression right now? I'm going to answer that for you. And then we have to sit there and scratch our heads and say, okay, well, once we get this, how is this going to play out in the future? Understanding that it's simply a matter of probabilities and not certainties. So with that intro, let's get into this exquisite drawing that I just did of the global monetary system. This is going to absolutely blow you guys away. As you guys can see, my handwriting is atrocious. And believe it or not, that's me trying to write extremely well. Like that's as good as it gets. You should see what it looks like when I'm not, you know, writing like a third grader with like a jumbo pencil and one of those pieces of paper with the big lines, you know, the dot in the middle. That's how slowly I'm writing all of this stuff. But okay, that said, so the start of this little drawing, if you want to call it that, let's go back to 1955. Or actually, maybe even 1944 with Bretton Woods. We'll go back even before the line started. So basically what we did is we pegged these currencies to the dollar. The dollar was pegged to gold. So dollar good as gold, right? And effectively what this did is this created a system where the dollar was the global reserve currency. In other words, for a lot and an ever-increasing amount of global transactions, regardless of whether or not they were between two counterparties that involved the United States or the or a U.S. corporation, they would be settled in dollars. So a lot of people get that, but they don't think about it in terms of the real-world application. Let's just assume you make widgets, and you are making your widgets in Colombia. And let's go back to 1950. And you're making your widgets in Colombia, but now in order to expand your operations, you've got to buy equipment. You've got to buy stuff. Maybe you've got to buy oil. Maybe you've got to buy commodities. Maybe you have to buy something from another country. And this other country says, sure, Colombian corporation, we will sell you what you need to grow your business and to expand the Colombian economy and build wealth. Because what is wealth, guys? You know this from watching my videos. It's simply how efficiently a society can produce goods and services. It has nothing to do with green pieces of paper, gold, or Bitcoin, or anything like that. It's simply how efficiently a society, how much stuff do you make, right? So they're wanting to produce more stuff. But now all of a sudden, they've got a problem. Because let's just take it to an extreme and say that no Colombian banks have dollars, or they don't have enough dollars to lend to this corporation. Let's say the corporation needs $1 billion to expand. And they're like, whoop, sorry, there's no bank that can give you that much money because, or that many dollars, because we don't even have that many dollars. So what does the corporation do? They're like, well, okay, I guess I'm SOL. But the banks understand that there is not only significant demand for dollar loans that would be lent productively to productive entities that could pay them back with interest. So there's a profit opportunity there, but they've got a problem. Again, they don't have enough dollars. So what was the game plan for supplying dollars to the world? Well, the US would just have to run massive trade deficits, because if we import goods, we export what? Dollars. So if we were importing goods from that Colombian widget maker, they'd be giving us the goods, the stuff. We would be giving them dollars. They would take those dollars and deposit them with their bank. And now all of a sudden that bank has dollars. And now they don't lend out the dollars. I don't want to go down that path. But they basically, this expands their dollar lending capacity. So they can create more dollar loans, because now all of a sudden they've got this dollar deposit from XYZ Colombian widget company selling their widgets to the United States, because we didn't make those widgets ourselves. So we had to import them. So hopefully this is starting to make sense. So the banksters look at this and they say, well, my gosh, there's this huge profit opportunity. And again, this is 1950, let's say, or early 1950s. And they're like, boy, well, if we could just come up with the amount of dollars, we could make a killing. And the global economy could grow on all eight cylinders. It wouldn't be, the growth wouldn't be hampered, because there's so many productive loans that are out there. So what they did is they kind of scratched their head and they said, well, wait a minute here. Why do we even need the dollars? Why don't we create liabilities on our balance sheet? We create money. When someone gets a loan from us, whether it's pesos or dollars, that money didn't exist before. And we don't need the pesos because we have so many peso deposits. And if we lend someone the money, it increases the deposits by however much we lend. And the only reason we actually need something, dollars, pesos, on as far as assets on our balance sheet, is because if the entity we lend to, where we create those new currency units, wants to transfer those currency units to another bank to pay for something, what are we going to send them? See, this is the dilemma. But what the banksters did was say, well, wait a minute here. Why don't we just all open accounts with ourselves, and we'll fund the accounts with loans to each other. So now let me walk through that, except I may have lost some of you right there. So let's just say that we've got Bank A and Bank B. All righty. Well, Bank A says, okay, Bank B, we'll give you an account with us and we'll fund it with $100 million. And Bank B says, yeah, cool. So what's the offsetting asset going to be? Well, it's going to be a loan. That's their asset. They just gave or created currency units for Bank B to the tune of $100 million. Now, all of a sudden, Bank B has $100 million in their deposit account, their checking account, let's say. Bank B has their $100 million with Bank A. So Bank A has an additional $100 million liability. But they lent the money, technically, to Bank B. So they have a $100 million loan as the asset on their balance sheet to offset the $100 million deposit they just created for Bank B, right? And then Bank B just does the same thing. So then if Bank B creates a dollar loan, let's say for $50 million, and then they send that $50 million liability back to Bank A, well, then Bank A just reduces the balance in their checking account by $50 million. Problem solved. See what we've done? We've created a system that doesn't need bank reserves. That's why Snyder always says this is a cashless, reserveless system. And who's going to call you out on it? What, you think that corporation XYZ that makes widgets is going to have a $100 million in their account with you that you created out of thin air, and they're going to say, oh, I want the green pieces of paper? Of course not. You're in Colombia. What do you want green pieces of paper for? It's not like the bank was in the U.S. where you might have a customer come down and say, okay, let's say you got $100,000 in your account. I want my $100,000 in cash. No, you're in Colombia. So how many customers are going to come in there and say, hey, I want my $100,000 in cash, dollars, not pesos? Very few. So since you have so few people demanding cash because it's in another currency that they can't use locally, and because you've created a way to where you're funding the transfers basically through other banks' liabilities and extending you credit. And yes, it becomes very incestuous because all these banks' assets are just liabilities of other banks. And there's no final settlement. And even if Bank B pays Bank A back or vice versa, what are they paying them back with? They're just paying them back with other bank liabilities that were created the exact same way. They're not settling in bank reserve. They're not settling on the Fed's balance sheet. They're not settling with green pieces of paper. They're not settling with gold. They're not settling with Bitcoin. You see how this system works? It's simply operated on the bank's balance sheets. Now, let me prove this to you right here. Now we're going to my wonderful drawing. And I think I actually went over this in a video last week, but I'm going to expand on this. So even if you watch that video, you're still going to learn a lot. So if we go back to, let's say, 1950, 1960, we can see the amount of reserves, bank reserves, that were held at the Fed. So this would be an asset of the banks, but one of the tools that they use or can use to create dollar-denominated loans. And they can have subsidiaries in the United States. So this, even though it's HSBC or Cayman Island Bank 123, it still might be reflected with the bank reserves at the Fed, even though they might not have an account through a subsidiary, correspondent, banking relationship, etc. So the Fed's balance sheet is pretty much flat. No, not their balance sheet, I'm sorry. The amount of reserves, the amount of bank reserves held at the Fed, pretty much flat. In fact, I point out from 1987 to 2007, the amount of the reserves in the system went down, not up. In 87, we had about 60 billion with a B. In 2007, before the GFC, 40, went down by $20 billion. Yet, at the same time, M2 money supply went from, call it 2.7 trillion up to 7.5 trillion. What happened to the global economy, the global supply of dollars from 1987 to 2007? Did it go down? No. It not only went up, it went parabolic, way, way up. So what this tells us is exactly what I was saying, that the euro dollar system that sprung up out of necessity, let's call it in the early 1950s as a result of Bretton Woods, was supplying pretty much 99% of the global dollar liquidity needed for the global economy. All right. So this is a system that's pretty much completely on the bank's balance sheet. The Fed balance sheet down here, pretty much flat. So we get to a point in 2007, and this line that I have right in the middle, this represents economic growth, so global economic growth. So just to put it in terms we can all understand, in 2007, the global economy is pretty much running on all eight cylinders via this, to a certain degree, free market system that was set up in 1955, the euro dollar system. Now, I would argue that one of the key flaws that brought us to the collapse in 2007, like I said earlier, was the bailout of long-term capital management. Because once all the banksters saw that the Fed would bail them out, are they going to take more risk or less risk? Of course, they're going to take more risk. Why not take risk? The Fed's just going to bail me out. So if they're taking more and more risk with their balance sheet, well, sure, if their balance sheet is connected to the Eurodollar system, and the Eurodollar system effectively is the global monetary system, therefore the global economy, then yes, that means the global economy is risk on, baby. We got risk layered on top of risk, layered on top of risk and risk. Now, is that because the free market did that? No, it's because the central planners interfered with the free market by propping up long-term capital management, among many other things. So we get to 2007, late 2007, economy, global economy running on all eight cylinders, same with the monetary system, but it is becoming more and more and more levered, more and more fragile. Now, what happened, let's call it, I don't know if it was 71, but I think the petrodollar had a lot to do with it, is we had this relationship going back and forth with these banks, but it was kind of like a buddy-buddy system. You can imagine if you were Bank B or Bank A, and you were just, I'll give you a loan if you give me a loan, and then we're just kind of reliant upon each other for all of our liquidity. Or if you're paying off that loan with Bank C's liabilities that you get from Bank C, well, now all of a sudden Bank A has to trust Bank C that they're good because it's their liability. And like, hey, I don't know Bank C. I just know Bank B. So what ended up happening is they start to provide liquidity that is collateralized. And I think, and I don't know for sure, but I would assume that one of the reasons they transitioned into this model is because the system's growing, and they're having to become more and more reliant upon banks that they don't know. Additionally, if you include the petrodollar system, what did we do? Well, now all of a sudden, to buy gold or oil, at least from OPEC, you got to have dollars. So this increases the dollar demand. This increases the dollar loans. This increases the amount of settlements as a percentage of global GDP that are settled in dollars, right? So if we've got all these dollars going to Saudi Arabia, what are they going to do with those dollars? You guys know this. They're going to buy treasuries. So now all of a sudden, you've got all these treasuries that are going on the balance sheets of entities and banks outside the US. So they're like, perfect. Let's just use these treasuries as collateral. Great. And let's just blow up the system even more. Let's expand it even further, because now I don't even have to trust you to take your liability. And we don't even have to settle. Who cares? Because if you're not good for it, well, I've got this treasury. And then insert mortgage-backed securities. Same thing. Woohoo! Let's expand to the moon. Because now we know the Fed's going to bail us out because of long-term capital management. And we have even more collateral in the form of all of these mortgages that the United States is throwing off and the banksters are throwing off. Let's party like it's 1999, baby. You see how this thing evolved. And now you can see and understand why the GFC really wasn't about subprime. It wasn't about mortgages. Is about the total collapse of the Eurodollar system and the global monetary system. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. If you want further proof, go ahead and look at a chart of the mortgage default rate in 2008. Now remember, Bear Stearns went kaputs in, I believe it was July of 2008, and it's either June or July. And Lehman went bust in September. So you would assume, if you had this preconceived notion that the GFC was all about subprime mortgages, that, you know, in the typical story you hear is, well, the mortgages all went bad. No one was paying their loans. Everyone was delinquent. So now all of a sudden these, the balance sheets blow up from all these greedy banksters that had all these mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheet and use these mortgage-backed securities to create all these derivatives. That's the common story you get. Wrong. Wrong. Not true. Not true. What? What happened is they were, they were taking these mortgage-backed securities. That is true. But what happened prior to those mortgage-backed securities blowing up is they went bust. So actually, this was a self-fulfilling prophecy because the Eurodollar system saw the Fed raising rates, which they did, started, I believe, in 2006 into 2007. And then, in my opinion, they probably looked around and said, maybe some of these subprime mortgages are kind of risky. And then we had the decoupling of LIBOR and Fed funds. Now, Snyder always talks about this. It was August 9th of 2007. We had the decoupling of those two rates. So what that told you instantly is all of a sudden there was a shortage of dollars outside of the United States and an abundance of dollars inside of the United States. So that means the Eurodollar system broke right then and there. So this preceded Bear Stearns. Not only that, if you go back to 2007, the mortgage delinquency rate was like 3%, maybe 4%, something like that. Now, it did go up. That is true. But I've looked at charts, several charts, going back into the 1980s, and as an example, in the early 1990s, the delinquency rate was up near 6%. So how can you say that it was because of mortgages going bad when we had a higher delinquency rate in the 1990s? You say, well, we had all these subprime loans and blah, 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 and that kind of had this cascading effect. Well, I mean, okay, to some degree, but that's not going to happen if delinquencies go from 2% to 3%, for heaven's sakes. I mean, come on. And I think it, right off the top of my head, I think even in the middle of 2008, after Bear kind of went bust or was absorbed, delinquencies were still below that 6%, maybe 4-5. Now, what happened is then they really started to go up. And then after Lehman, then they go up. And then you get to like the middle of 2009. And we got up to like 10% or something like that, which still, I think if most people heard that delinquencies only got up to 10%, they would be surprised. I think if you kind of, you know, watch The Big Short and whatnot, you just assume that the delinquency rate was like 50% or something like that. Not even close. Just slightly above where it has been several times throughout our history. And by the way, you know, mortgage-backed securities weren't created in the early 2000s. They were created a long time ago. So when they had the blow up in, or when delinquencies went up to, let's say, 6% in the 90s, we had mortgage-backed securities. They were on the bank's balance sheets. So, you know, sure, we could have had some other derivatives, but again, this wouldn't create a total global meltdown. This would create a lot of problems on the bank's balance sheets, but not to where these things, these banks are going bust. That's my point here. So the mortgages there, it started, it kind of triggered it. It was basically like that last snowflake that is the catalyst to the avalanche. Like what caused the avalanche? Was it the snowflake, or was it all the snowflakes that had fallen before that created a very unstable environment to where that last snowflake, all it needed to where it triggers the collapse? See, it wasn't the fault of that last snowflake. It was the entire system. That was the problem. So what happened? Well, you guys remember, Ben Bernanke came out with massive quantitative easing. So this, the Fed's balance sheet basically goes parabolic. And in what, 14, 15 after QE3, the Fed's balance sheet had gone to about $4 trillion. The bank reserves went from $40 billion with a B to 14, 15, right at the top of my head, I think it was around $3 trillion with a T, $3 trillion. And although it's in the shadows, we can assume because of what happened to global economic growth even after 2009, that the Eurodollar system collapsed and the Fed's balance sheet was basically subsidizing the lack of activity from a broken Eurodollar system. So again, putting this in terms we can all understand, we went from the Eurodollar system running on all eight cylinders to the Eurodollar system barely running on four cylinders. And then the Fed's balance sheet had to pick up the remaining four cylinders. So you may say to yourself, well, George, what's the big deal there? We're still running on all eight cylinders. It's just the Fed had to pick up the slack. No. What you're not remembering is that this is a free market system. This is central planning. So which system is going to operate more efficiently? So in other words, we've got four cylinders that are being operated by FedEx, and the other four cylinders are being operated by DMV. So can we expect that system to function as efficiently as a system where all eight cylinders are operated by FedEx? Absolutely not. So what we did there during the Eurodollar buildup is you had a system that was completely dependent upon trust, faith, then collateral. It was free market, but then you move into a system that is ever increasingly dependent upon the Fed's balance sheet. Therefore, ever increasingly dependent upon central planning. Now, let's take it to the next step here. Most of you guys know from watching this channel and listening to other awesome people out there like Schiff and Brent and Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh and whatnot, and Luke Groman, you realize that the Fed is in a bind. And sure, they may have stopped quantitative easing, and they're talking about doing quantitative tightening in June, but how long is that going to last? You guys know as well as I do, there is zero probability that they take their balance sheet back down to $800 billion. What I'm saying is there's zero probability we ever go back to this system. I mean, just think about that. Right now, there's about, oh, right off the top of my head, I'd say $4 trillion in bank reserves. You think we're going to take that back down to $40 billion and we're just going to be off to the races? No chance. No chance. It's monetary heroin, just like Schiff says. So once you start the drug, you need more and more and more of it. That's what, look at Japan. That's what QE does. Look at Europe, same thing. So we may be able to stop the QE for a moment in time, but I mean, trust me, we're going to go right back to the QE spigot probably sooner than later. know, maybe 2023, I don't know, maybe sooner, who knows. But the bottom line is the next little crisis we have, what are they going to do? A standard operating procedure. Drop rates, do more QE. So what is QE? What does it do? It's where the Fed buys treasuries. Well, what are treasuries? They're collateral. So as the Fed does more and more quantitative easing, it starves the system that's already sputtering, just running on four cylinders. It's starving that system of the collateral it needs to provide the global liquidity. And the Fed knows this, and you know they know this, because if you go back to 2019, when they tried to prop up repo, they did so initially by buying T-bills. And then all of a sudden they said, reverse. Sorry about that. We didn't mean that. Sorry, market. Sorry. And then what did they do? They started buying long-dated treasuries. They started buying the long end of the curve instead of the short end. Why? Because the short end is the pristine collateral the repo market needs, the very repo market that they're trying to prop up. So they know damn well how important the collateral is. So what do? Well, they set up reverse repo. You guys know that. And they set up the SRF, I believe. It's the standing repo facility. I believe that's the abbreviation there, and that's what it's called. But basically, it's just like a permanent repo facility at the Fed. And they did this about a year ago. And I think it's obvious because they know that they need to be the lender of last resort. It can't be the euro dollar system anymore because they're taking collateral out of the system. And therefore, they're starving the system. They know that by doing what they're doing, and they don't have a choice, they have to do QE, or the whole house of cards comes crashing down, that they're basically kneecapping the existing system or what's left of it. So they have to backstop that by putting in their own reverse repo and repo facility. So if or when the entire Eurodollar system collapses, the entities involved can get their liquidity from the Fed's balance sheet. And you say, oh, well, George, well, great, fantastic. Well, they've solved the problem. Woohoo! No, they haven't. Because then what we do is we go from all eight cylinders being run by the free market to four cylinders to zero cylinders. And we go to the Fed and central planners running all eight cylinders of the global monetary system. Therefore, the global economy is completely dependent upon the bureaucrats at the Fed, or maybe Janet Yellen, whichever you prefer, maybe Christine Lagarde, maybe Klaus. So the more that DMV is in control of the global economy, what's going to happen to the global economy? What's going to happen to economic growth? We see that the trend for economic growth really just completely, not flatlines, it's still going up, but the trend really decelerates when the system broke in 2007. And, you know, the United States was growing at 3%, 4%, 5%, something like that in real terms. And since then, it's been 1%, 2%. It's been anemic growth is what they would call it. And that doesn't even include the Cerveza sickness. But if that's not just the United States, that's the entire global economy. Well, that makes sense because we've gone from this free market system to a hybrid system where now half of it's dependent on DMV. So if we have seen global growth really start to grind to a halt, and now with what they're doing with the Cerveza sickness and the supply chains, most likely going to get a lot worse. You combine that with the Fed's balance sheet being more and more and more responsible for providing dollar liquidity. What does that do to economic growth? It makes it decelerate even faster. And when I'm talking about global economic growth, I'm not just saying in nominal terms. You know, we could have, who knows, 5-6% nominal growth, but still have declining real growth when you adjust for the rate of inflation. Remember, you can have an inflationary recession. You can have an inflationary depression. It doesn't have to be deflationary or disinflationary. So this is pretty much the gist. Actually, there's a couple more things here. There's other reasons why the Fed is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place and why they're going to have to extract more collateral from the system. I forgot to go over these. Number one, let's just assume that they don't do quantitative easing. They're not buying. Well, what's going to happen to rates? Let's say they keep doing QT to give the system the collateral it needs, or not really that it needs it, but it still wouldn't be functioning properly, but give the system more collateral, the collateral that's on the Fed's balance sheet. Okay, well, that means rates go up. Think about that. If an interest rate goes up, what happens to the price of the treasury? Goes down. Okay. Well, if you need that $1 billion worth of liquidity, let's just take it to an extreme. And let's just say that the price of the treasuries gets cut in half. Okay. Well, if the price gets cut in half, now all of a sudden you need twice the number of treasuries for the same amount of liquidity. This is what nobody talks about. So rates going up, all things being equal, assuming we had the same number of treasuries or T-bills in the system, means that the collateral that you have access to, or the demand for the collateral, goes up because you need more of those collateral units to equal the same dollar amount. Okay, we say, well, rates won't go up, George, because they'll just do yield curve control. Fine, great. They'll keep rates down. What is yield curve control? It just means that the Fed's buying the darn bonds. The Fed's buying the treasuries. If they're buying the treasuries, it's the same as QE. There's no more collateral. The main takeaway here is we were running on a free market system that was far from perfect. And it was, I think, put on steroids, which brought it to its final demise because of the bailouts of long-term capital management, creating a system where there was no downside to taking on additional risk, massive amounts of additional risk. And so then in 2007, we go from a free market system to a hybrid system that's basically central planning took over four cylinders, and the free market was four cylinders, but they were sputtering. Again, using the example of FedEx and DMV. Now, and this created less economic growth, really grinding to a halt globally, which, by the way, if the population is going up like this and growth is like this, what happens to standard of living? Goes like this. So now, because of this moral hazard back with long-term capital management, we get to this system where the Fed is taking over. They're doing quantitative easing. They have to do quantitative easing to prop up the house of cards and this monetary heroin addict that is our economy. But in doing so, they're taking away the collateral, which makes the Eurodollar system, the free market part of what we have, weaker and weaker and weaker. Therefore, the Fed or DMV has to take over more and more and more as a percentage of the global liquidity needs, dollar needs. This means global growth grinds to a halt, starts to go down. And they're in a position where they can't do anything about it. Therefore, we see a global economic depression. Probably long-term, probably throughout this decade, on and off. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a deflationary depression. It can definitely be an inflationary depression where we have negative economic growth and definitely negative economic growth relative to the increase in the population. And the global monetary system is going to be more and more and more centralized. And it's going to become more and more dependent upon the Fed's balance sheet. That's the main takeaway. So guys, hopefully that was easy to follow. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon. And as always, make sure that you're standing up for freedom, liberty, free market capitalism. And I never, ever ask this of you, but in this one instance, I would request that you share this with someone you know that you think would find value in these insights, because you know this is why I do this channel. This is why I do YouTube. It's to try to open up people's eyes. And throughout my entrepreneurial career, if I learned one thing, it's you got to know what you don't know. And there are so many of your friend and family member Freds out there, the average Joe and Jane, that have no idea what they don't know. And hopefully this video will open up their eyes. We'll see you next time.